You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.
Hello, this is Christopher Avery, the Responsibility Process Guy, and you're listening to the Agile Uprising Podcast.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising Podcast. I'm Brad Stokes. We're joined today by our guest, Dina Goffman. Hi, Dina. How are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm really well. We're going to talk about project accounting today, but before we get into all that, which I know for some, they're hearing project accounting and they're shuddering in their seats. They don't have to. But before we do all that, how about we grab a little bit of info about you? Dina, why don't you introduce yourself and maybe give us a little intro into what project accounting actually is?
Sure. I am in a very interesting space. This sort of preamble of what project accounting is and where I fit into it is a bit of a long story, but over the past decade, what I found with a whole bunch of colleagues is a bit of a gap between people's understanding of what finance is in the agile world and what accounting is as a field and how does it actually fit into all of this. I decided to take a year off while having a baby and do a bit of research into this field and spent a good year researching and came up with a bit of a framework to guide this entire, I guess, sphere into what I believe project accounting should be, with a lot of input from a whole bunch of peers within the field, both from the agile and project management world and accounting world. And it's come out to be a very interesting understanding of what project accounting used to be, which is your sort of, here's your waterfall project and here's your finance person that helps you along with tracking, you know, how your finances are going. And at some point you get told you run out of money or not. And that's pretty much what it historically used to be. It's heading into a bit murkier waters as to what it has been in the past couple of years and is now shaping up to be a very dynamic sort of way of how do we go about actually understanding what value agile projects are delivering and how do we help that journey along as finance colleagues and as agileists ourselves to actually help interpret, you know, the numbers that we're actually seeing the projects deliver and the benefits and just the overall picture that the project is trying to deliver within its actual sphere. So this is what a bit of a long preamble as to what I'm trying to get to within this field, with a lot of support from both worlds, which have been fantastic. My background is from working with ASX companies, a lot of very large projects, to the startup world. I've run a couple of my own startups, I still do, and helped a lot of startups along the way deliver fantastic products and solutions out there, and now in the sphere of kind of passing on the knowledge and helping develop ways of working within this complex world.
Yeah, you mentioned that you're working with agile teams to help them figure out how they get the value and not just run out of money halfway through, because I guess part of it is agile is very much focused on the delivery mechanisms, but underlying that delivery mechanism there's a whole bunch of infrastructure and other things and other support structures that help them. One of those is the finance and accounting team.
That's right.
You're talking about the old way of work. Why is there such a clash between that old way of working and the old style of accountancy and project finance and what we now have in the agile space?
Yeah, I guess for those of us that have read a lot of the sort of lean and agile literature out there, what you're seeing more and more in that literature is this whole concept of lean budgeting, lean accounting, lean ways of working within finance. But there's actually, when you then go to the accounting department, especially in Australia, what you'll see is that you'll literally get a huh from a lot of your colleagues in finance, because they don't really understand that sphere. They don't really understand terminology that's there. So what you'll get is, you know, potential interest, which is great. And what you'll mostly get is complete confusion. So what ends up happening is, as someone working in Agile and Scrum and any of those ways of working, you talk about lean budgeting, you talk about how you can use all of those. But then when you go to your sort of finance colleagues for help to develop that infrastructure, what you'll see is that 80% of the organizations in Australia are still working in very historical accounting ways. And that's actually got to do with a lot of the accounting standards rules that are put out by the accounting standard boards, by international financial reporting boards, which don't really give you much guidance out there of how you can then take that sort of really high level information and then help along your colleagues in the project management world and the agile sphere as well.
You've mentioned a couple of times the Australian focus, because that's where you're based. You're based out of Australia.
Right. I am based out of Australia.
This is an international issue, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. And I'm encountering the same issue with a lot of my counterparts who have now moved into England and America. And it's the same issue over and over again. And, you know, we're all talking and we're all kind of going, well, you know, we're all smart people. We can definitely figure this out. We can definitely develop ways of making this easier for everybody.
The question then is, given that it's an international issue, given that we've got this old standard, and project accounting seems to be about bridging that gap between the old ways of working into something that fits into a modern delivery framework, how does one start to look at the process of actually engaging with, say, their finance colleagues about making this leap of faith?
I'd say that there's a number of ways of really doing that. And one of the first ways is actually understanding the language they speak, right? So unless you're speaking the same language, you're almost bound to not get much of a response, right? So when you go to your finance and accounting counterpart, if you're not talking in the language they're talking, you're almost bound to not get what you want. And which is why I encourage you to actually get a little bit of more of an understanding of the actual terminology, the language that's being used by your accounting counterparts. What does CAPEX and OPEX mean in their worlds? What does things like capitalization rules mean? What do all of those little bits and pieces that fit into their world and what they care about, and then they guide your budget, actually really makes quite a difference to then your world as well. So first step really is to just, if you're, you know, not, you know, wanting to spend a lot of time researching, is come see me and let's have a chat about it. I can send you a whole bunch of materials. We're running courses, doing a whole bunch of those sorts of things. The next step, if you don't want to do that and want to actually delve into all of that and do a lot of research on your own, there's a lot of resources out there. Type in, you know, anything from Chartered Accountants Australia and type in project accounting. You'll get a one-pager summary that will actually tell you what a project accountant should be doing for you to even start with. So it's things like that and resources like that that may actually be quite helpful to you.
So how does the whole thing fit together? Because do you see project accountants as being another stakeholder, say, to a delivery team, or are they a partner on that delivery team? I mean, we already have a bit of a dichotomy between understanding that a project manager isn't necessarily the same as a product owner, although the roles can have some overlap. Is the project accountant just another person that the project manager needs, or the product owner needs to keep at arm's length? Or how does that work?
It's interesting, right? Because the accounting sphere is very much driving themselves as these new title of, you know, your financial advisor, your financial business partner. That's the terminology that accountants like to use about themselves now. And the reason they've changed that as well is because the moment AI starts playing in that space and robotics, and they're all of a sudden realizing they can't just do journals and that's it, and actually need to talk to their stakeholders, is the moment that they realize that actually need to bring value to the project management sphere as well. So since they're seeing themselves as the partners and the advisors to all of us, right, as project managers and agilists, will use that in a way of actually getting them to do so, right? So I would actually say that they're not so much a stakeholder as a partner, as a really important partner that needs to be engaged, and they need to be engaged back as well.
So we talked about language before. I'm just circling back around. Mm. You mentioned CapEx, OpEx. For a non-accountant, for a everyday Scrum Master and Agilist, hit me with some of the terms that I am likely to run into. And I know I've heard of EBITDA, I've got CapEx, I've got OpEx, I've got shareholders' equity, which I know there's all these wonderful ones. But what are some of the must-haves that I need to even have to begin the conversation?
Yeah, well, what's an asset to begin with? What's your expenses? What are actually your expenses? What's the difference between an asset and an expense? What's the difference between an asset and a liability? That's a really big one I usually get from engineers. There's a whole variety of terms that they're great to understand, but when you open even your sort of Investopedia and you look them up, you'll get a definition that won't actually make sense to your project, right? So understanding how do those words then fit into your project is actually very important, right? So things like, I would say, geez, terminology, there's so much out there.
CapEx versus OpEx.
CapEx versus OpEx. Did you know that OpEx is actually not just operational expenditure? There's a difference between what OpEx is in terms of what it means for a project and what it means outside of your project, right? So the OpEx that you're delivering within the project is actually different to the OpEx that you're then impacting out of the project, right? So some of the benefits and you're delivering, so for example, when you're reducing maintenance costs, that's OpEx that you're impacting as opposed to OpEx that's part of your project, right? So understanding where do both of those sorts of things fit in is actually very important, and how the organization treats those, because there is no standardized way of doing that.
Well, that makes it easy.
Yeah. So every organization has its own interpretation of the word OpEx when it comes to your project and outside of your project.
And CapEx, which I'm actually going to show off, a capitalized expense.
Yes.
You did listen to me.
Yeah, no, that's awesome.
I actually attended one of Dina's courses, which is how we met. The way I kind of think of this is it's kind of a way to offset debt and account for it against your profit and loss in future states. So it's actually a way to defer the accounting of that cost. How close am I thus far?
That's one way of looking at it, yes. Yep. I guess it's more spreading the benefit of what you're delivering over the years delivering it, right? So yep. That's probably a better way of looking at it, probably an easier way of looking at it. But even the word benefit is a interesting word that's often misused as a term around the place as well. And the question around that is tangibility of benefits, intangibility of benefits. You have hard, soft, which are almost the same thing, but how do you quantify some of those?
Yeah.
And that all leads to then how long your CapEx can last for and have a useful life against. Yes.
So for the layman, where do, say, a Scrum Master, let's go Scrum Master or a Product Owner, do you actually see them as finding use for understanding the world of project accounting, even if they're not doing?
Yeah, I would actually say that the entire team needs to be involved, right?
Okay.
So the reason the entire team needs to be involved is because the team knows whether or not they've delivered the value that they've said they're going to deliver. And where that's at, right?
Okay. So what are some of the preconditions then for the team engaging in the space to make use of the tools that project accounting may give you? Okay. So I believe one of the international standards is in order to capitalize an expense, you need to do record times.
That's right. Yeah. So in order to actually capitalize your asset, so create an asset in your books, you need to prove the tangibility of what you're creating, the usefulness of what you're creating. There are actually six rules that you need to tick off in order to actually have that happen, one of which is reliable measurement of your time and what you've actually spent your time on. So that's something that has very clear guidance around, yet because I guess it's hard to do, some people decide not to. right? But yeah. I think the entire team is very much involved with understanding the time that they spend on what they're doing in yeah. finding value out of it.
So what are those six preconditions? You mentioned six.
Yes. So it's actually, this is widely available information. You can completely see them and research them. So once you listen to the podcast, you can see them. So this is guidance given by the Accounting Standard Board. It's actually a standard AASB 138 for those of you who are interested. And those give you six preconditions. I'm just going to...
Oh, I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah, you're putting me on the spot. I just want to make sure that I've got them right in front of me because sometimes I get the order wrong, and the order is actually quite important in this.
Okay.
The first part that needs to be proven is the technical feasibility of completing the asset for use or sale. So this is your minimal marketable product that you're developing, not minimal viable product. So we all know there's a difference, but the minimal marketable product that you're actually developing that has actual value. You have to prove that you've got intention to complete, and this is not just the product owner and the team that needs to prove that intention. It's actually the organization needs to prove intention that they're going to complete what they've promised to complete as part of what you're delivering. You then need to prove the ability to use or sell what you're developing. You need to generate probable future economic benefits. And in doing so, you actually need to prove whether there's a market for your asset or how many internal users will be there to actually use that asset. So just because you're writing something absolutely fantastic, will people actually use it or can you sell it? You need to, as an organization, prove the availability of those resources and funding. So you actually need to have that allocated budget sitting with you to actually do the work, and resources must be made available to you. And the last one is reliably measuring all of this, or measuring your spend, whether you're using time tracking, whether you're using cost centers, sprints. How do you actually track all of that information in order to prove that you've actually spent the money on the right stuff?
Just out of curiosity, let's cycle back to the first one. Can you read that out for us again?
Yeah, that's technical feasibility of completing the asset.
Okay, so this actually sounds quite interesting in its own right.
Yeah.
So if we're talking something like double diamond design, where we're actually running a bunch of experiments and research to prove that we can do that. So the first step is you actually need to be able to complete it. Now, I'm guessing that can take a couple of different forms. That can be... yep, seen somebody else done it. It can be done. Yay, we're there. But I'm guessing for something more exploratory where you're actually testing a market, that's...
So this is the best part about it, right? So in those sort of circumstances where you're doing purely experimental work and you're going, well, you know what, nobody's really caring about this to the extent that it's going to be a capitalized asset. This is pure research activity. It's actually falling outside of those six rules into what we call R&D type activity, mm-hmm. right? And that's the words that are used by the standard is research activity. Now, the ATO has actually put out quite a lot of guidance around claiming R&D tax offsets, right? But in order to do that, you also need to track that.
And, of course, the research side of things will be place to place, even state to state can have different rules.
Absolutely. And each state has other grants that you can apply for and a whole variety of things that can help you along, but they all want proof.
They all want proof.
Mm.
So proof is actually, again, an interesting one. So if we're talking about some of the practices that we actually do within the Agile space, it might be you've got a Kanban board with cards that are flowing across it. If those cards are actually equating to, say, set time periods or at least a set amount of work for a given group of developers, is that sufficient to...
No, it's not actually sufficient. No, that's right. It's not sufficient to just put a kind of a forecast in your cards to kind of go, oh, well, this is how long it's going to take us. You then have to look back and go, well, how long did it take us? And what did we do in that time? So this is what we were meant to do. Now, what did we actually come out with?
Okay. So say we've gone through, we've created a proof of concept, we've tested it out, we know what we're trying to do is technically feasible. What was the next on the list then?
So the next on the list is intention to complete.
Intention,
that's right.
Intention's an interesting one.
Exactly.
Because I'm just thinking if we're talking a product focus versus a project focus, we might have an intention to continue maintaining this forever and enhancing this every 2 weeks, producing a new feature. Do we then look at, and the feature might be being around for the next 5-6 years.
Mm.
But the actual intention, do we actually have to start defining what we're releasing? So say, I know we use a feature like Story Maps where we release things into versions. Are the versions our intention to complete to a certain point and then reevaluate there? Sorry, I'm just thinking.
Yeah, no, this is a great question. I mean, this is something that we definitely need to explore more. It's definitely something that it depends, right? This is not a clear cut yes or no.
Okay.
This is a depends, right? So,
this is why you need project accountants.
This is why you need someone with you who's able to then help you along this.
You've established intention. What was the next? Let's keep going.
Ability to use or sell.
Ah, okay. So this one should be a little more clear cut.
A little bit more clear cut, yes.
Yeah. So, yes, we're going to build this widget XYZ. Be it whatever widget XYZ is, it's either going to be able to be used or it's not going to be able to be used and or hopefully sold, depending on what you're using it for. The next one is?
Generate probable future economic benefits.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay. Now,
which is a hard one.
Yes, it does sound like a hard one.
It's a really hard one because when we speak about economic benefits, what we often forget about is the uplift in cost as well, right? So just because your new widget is bringing in a lot of income, potentially, let's say, doesn't mean that it's actually costing you just as much to actually run it, right?
Yep.
So this is another one that's an interesting one to consistently look at proving. And nobody says that it has to be a negative or a positive number, but what is being not measured out there is the actual uplift in cost when you're bringing that in. So you're bringing future economic benefits, which are offset by additional OPEX.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I've got a new enhancement to my software, but it's going to take, say, 20% more CPU runtime.
Correct.
So I'm actually paying more for the CPU space the moment I deliver this thing.
That's right.
The economic benefit that I get from selling the extra feature may actually be completely offset by my extra costs of maintaining the feature out in the wild.
And that guides how long the useful life of what you're creating is, right? So that is a very important determination of whether you're going to get benefits that increase year on year, or whether you're going to get something that almost makes no monetary difference to you year on year, or even a negative difference to you year on year. And this is where proving your intangible benefits is very, very important as well, not just the tangible ones.
This could almost be a philosophical debate here.
Oh, absolutely. It really is.
I can imagine a number of developers are saying, well, look, honestly, if we're getting even zero benefit one way or the other, but we're improving our customers'
absolutely, and that's an intangible benefit in and of its own.
Mm-hmm. Might be an intangible benefit, might not actually give an economic thing, but it may still make it worthwhile.
Yeah, and or it may give an economic benefit, but is very, very difficult to quantify it, right? Maybe an indirect economic benefit.
Okay, so we're at number four. What was number five?
Number five is availability of resources and funding. And this talks to the organization making those resources and funding available to the project.
Okay. So it's great to have a project sitting there, but if no one's actually available to work on it or has no budget assigned to it, there's not much point trying to capitalize the expense that you incur across it because that seems almost self-evident.
Yeah.
You've got to have an expense to actually be able to capitalize said expense, I guess.
That's right. Exactly.
And the fifth one, the sixth one.
That leads into the reliable measuring of spend.
Yes.
Right. So that's the one that if that doesn't exist, none of the others do.
Makes sense. So when it says reliable measure of spend, now you mentioned actually a few different measures that could be used here. You mentioned sprints, you mentioned time, you mentioned literal cost
centers, so, profit centers, whatever the organization uses, but it's actually defining what belongs to the project, right? So that's, I guess, the easier way of understanding that is what is it that's truly project related and what is it that's not, right? So the reason I say that is, a very simple example would be people taking leave. If you're not, you know, costing that out and people aren't doing timesheets per turn, potentially, you're actually being charged for that time to your project.
Rich, as a project manager, hurts because you're trying
it
to
does.
Actually keep... Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And again, we're differentiating out the project manager versus the product owner. You can have a product owner that might not actually be interested in this stuff because a product owner isn't necessarily the same person as the project manager who's
agreed.
Worried about the costs.
Yeah, no,
so there's a little bit of a tension there, again, between the delivery
yeah.
and the tracking of that. So the project manager, if you've got people within that team that are disappearing for 3 weeks worth of leave, and those 3 weeks worth of leave are actually coming out against your project, that's a... can be a big expense for no gain whatsoever.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yet the expectation is you're still going to deliver, right?
Yes.
So it's an interesting one because unless you're actually tracking that and actually pointing that out to whatever steering committee you might have or whoever you're accountable to, whether it be sponsors and others, you're not going to get additional resources and additional funding.
Okay. So we've... decided that as a team we're going to track, well, I guess there's a few different ways we could track this. We can say we're doing X number of features or updates in a given sprint and we're just going to divide that cost. Are we able to then just divide, say we've got three features we're putting through in a given sprint, 2 week period, we've got four members of staff, every one of them's costing us on average $1,000 a day. So each week is $20,000.
Are we going to be doing mathematics in the podcast? Because this is going to be a really great one for the listeners.
We can do $20,000. I think they can follow along. We've got very smart people. We have very smart people.
I'm sure we do. That's not.
Okay. Let's say we've got $40,000 worth of expense on wages in a given 2 week period. We've done three features and we know that everybody's worked at least a little bit on every feature. Do we just say, okay, $40,000 divide by three, there's $13,300 allocated to each of the features, and that's how I'm going to count it? Or do we need to get more specific than that? Do I need to know that's X person?
Well, so it can be at that level, but then the question
okay.
arises to really when you're trying to understand the data behind it
mm-hmm.
is at the feature level.
Yep.
Really, how much of the feature was completed, right?
Okay.
And if you're not understanding at that level, how do you know how much further have you got to go?
Okay. So, I mean, we could actually say it could be feature, could be an epic.
It could be an epic. It can be at a sprint level. It can be as high as, you know, your sort of sub-project levels if you're putting it up to that point, or it can be as low as sprints, right? So it all depends on, first of all, the tools available to you and at what point do you want enough to then allow you to then understand what the forecast looks like for your program, right?
Yeah.
So that's an important term to also know about is what does your forecast look like for this program in order to drive your very old school term of estimate at completion, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your EAC, which is still a very relevant term. And that's what will drive your budget very strongly.
Okay. Now, just say, and I guess certain features, you might spend more time on them, but if the economic return isn't there, you might question the value
exactly.
they're bringing.
That's exactly right.
So this is trying to find another way to look and assess the value of what you're actually,
exactly.
the work that you're doing?
That's right. So
am I getting this?
Absolutely. You're definitely taking it straight out of my course, which is awesome. It's exactly right. So just because you had a couple of people working on a feature that was working fantastic, did it actually then fail when you tested it and required complete rework?
Yeah. And you might abandon a feature
might
in
abandon
which case.
It.
And if you abandon a feature, I guess that, depending on your definition of how you're tracking the capitalization of
exactly.
the actual, you
yes.
might actually lose some of your capitalization there as well.
That's
so,
exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
I can imagine this giving people headaches.
Oh, and that's the thing is I think – people generally just look at this and just go, this is too hard. But it doesn't
yeah.
have to be. Because
okay.
once you understand the basics of it all, and you understand what tools are available to you to use, you can almost set it up for you and it'll work like clockwork. It'll fit right into your sprint planning. It'll fit right into your sprint reviews, and you'll literally come out with a beautiful picture at the end of each month, understanding exactly where you're at.
I could see, like, from a Scrum Master perspective, I'm just trying to play this out from my own perspective. I can see at a Scrum Master level, you might go, I'm not 100% sold, but I can see from my product owner perspective. So someone who's really got their eye on the gain and the value of what is being delivered would be very interested in this, because again, that value, that tangible benefit for the business, the reason that you're doing it, and the benefit for the customer, that this just provides you another lens to be able to assess that. It may not be the best lens. You might just say, look, well, screw it. It's customer delight is the thing that we're actually, the metric we're chasing. This is something I'll track, so my accountancy people are happy. So I need to know about it, but the way I'll make decisions, it's just because something is returning you less
economic. How are you measuring
benefit.
Customer delight?
Well, that's a question. Mm. Are we doing net promoter scores? Are we doing, even those are somewhat problematic, but how are we doing this?
All of them are problematic, but all of them are quantifiable.
Yeah.
There are ways to actually quantify all of that stuff.
Yes.
Which directly correlates to the numbers you'll then see in your budgets and your financials. There are direct correlations that have been proven out there that can be used.
It's giving you a richer picture of the thing that you're building. It's not saying that you're bad, bad, bad if you don't have this already. It's quite saying, actually, what you're doing is you're giving yourself a better lens to appreciate this from another perspective.
What you're giving yourself is proof that what you're doing is on the right track.
Okay.
Or on the wrong track.
Or on the wrong track, which is also very important.
That's right. So
we're running
the
really fast, but we're running in the wrong direction.
The reason I'm in this sphere to begin with is the amount of on the wrong track that I've seen too late.
So you're talking about this actually potentially acting as an early indicator.
Correct. This is your lead indicators as to whether your project requires help.
Okay. Do you want to go into that a little bit more? How would somebody use this to say, Houston, we have a problem. We're 3 months in on a 12-month project.
Yeah.
But we know we have a problem, and it's not just delivery.
Every sprint that you spend, every month that you spend on your project, you know how much it's costing and you know how much you're delivering by tracking. So at the end of each month, generally it's at the end of each month because unfortunately accountants can't keep up before that. What you'll see, it's the reality of accounting systems today. What you will see is a clearer picture of whether you are about to impact the entire end life cycle of the actual program. Because you know that you've been given a finite amount of resources and a finite amount of money. And that's generally the case for the majority of the projects we get. Yeah. And so you've only got so many levers that you can pull. And we all know, I assume we all know about the golden triangle, right?
Oh,
your scope, is it one lever? Your quality is another lever, although I'll be debated about that to end of time, your time and your cost, right? So those are the only levers until someone proves that one out otherwise that you are available to you to pull. And so by understanding your financial picture ahead of time, at the end of each month, at the end of hopefully each sprint down the track, you're actually able to call out, you know what, we're actually running out of money, or we're running significantly under, and we can actually add some more features in here, and we can add more value to this thing.
Or the one that scares people, but probably is one of the most useful things, is saying, you know what, we're actually barking up the wrong tree.
We're
3 months in, and we are completely barking up the wrong tree. This will not give us the benefits we want. It's not going to delight our customers. We really need to kill this thing. Not we've spent 8 months. Sorry, this is a bugbear of mine. But
It's a bugbear of mine too. I completely agree with you.
It's actually understanding the sunk costs are sunk. There's absolutely nothing that you can do about sunk costs. They're there. But then investing another 9 months in something that isn't going to deliver the benefits makes no sense, especially when you've got another something to back up that argument.
And psychologically, people get very scared by that notion.
Yeah, and the other one is, it's one of the things I've heard when you've identified something that's going wrong is, I need data. bring me the data, show me how this is right. And there's a very reluctance, there's a big reluctance, and it's called the status quo bias, but there's a big reluctance to move outside of the status quo, because status quo is project goes on. That's normal. Status quo, which is not, we terminate this project because it is not going to do what it is. So when you're pushing into that status quo bias, the first thing that you'll generally hear is bring me data. And this is hard quantifiable data that the people that say bring me data actually listen to will probably listen to.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And at the same time, there's nothing wrong with data as long as it's being read in the correct way and not just proving whatever you're trying to prove at the time.
This is true too.
Yeah. So, I mean, and that's the one thing about, I guess, project accounting as a sphere in general. Without data, that whole sphere doesn't exist.
Yeah. Okay, so we're coming up on time. I want to be respectful for your time.
Sure.
So final thoughts on going forward. How and where can listeners start to bring this practice, bring the project accountancy space into their delivery practice or into their project management practice or into just their general work practice?
Absolutely. So I guess one of the bigger ones is contacting myself at Project Accounting Australia and letting us know you're interested in this sphere. As well, the partnership between Access Agile and Project Accounting Australia, so allowing to then put some more courses out there, sending me an email. I mean, I'm completely available to have a chat to people about whatever issues they're encountering. And if they need further guidance, happy to help. You can reach me through the website, so projectaccounting.com.au, or one of the other resources. I've released a book out there called Forgetting the Money.
So where can people find that book?
So either on Amazon, you can, it's an ebook format on Amazon, or through our or Lulu, which is the hard book copy version, on our website as well, projectaccounting.com.au is another resource which has quite a bit on there, and we've got articles and a whole variety of blogs and things that you can read through that might be helpful as well.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Dina, and thank you to our guests and our listening audience out there. If you've enjoyed this episode, please give us a review or rating, leave a comment on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcasting platform of choice. It really helps others to find us. If this is your first time tuning in, hey, why not subscribe to the podcast? If you'd like to join the discussion and share your stories about how you make project accounting work within your organization or your experience even with dealing with accountants as an agilist, or worst case scenario, best craft beer that you've had recently, come and join us on the coalition.agileuprising.com. And finally, support from our listeners like you will help us cover our costs of hosting and production. You can see the show notes for details on how you can become a Patreon. Until next time, this is the Agile Uprising signing out.
Mother's Day is almost here, and you can get her the most beautiful time-tested gift around, a watch she can wear every day from Movement. Whether your mom is into classic dress watches, rare and refined ceramics, or tried-and-true bestsellers, Movement has something she'll love. And right now, everything at Movement is up to 50% off site-wide during their Mother's Day sale. A watch is a gift that celebrates all the time you spent with mom, and a Movement watch is even more than that. Movement uses industry-leading materials for their fresh modern watch designs, from technically complex ceramics to vintage-inspired style, all for an incredible value your wrist and wallet will both love. And with one-size-fits-all convenience and fast free shipping and returns, it's a stress-free shopping experience. Save big on the best Mother's Day gift ever with Movement. Get up to 50% off site-wide during their Mother's Day sale at MVMT.com. Again, that's up to 50% off at MVMT.com.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pair.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.